just give me a little bit of background about life before you arrived at Greenham Common in 1989, isn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. So I was 18 in 1989. So I hadn't really got going on my life before I went to Greenham. I'd just done the usual things, going to school, sitting exams, and then wondering what to do next. I obviously grew up at the height of the Cold War, when the world seemed like quite a scary and insane place, with two of the world's superpowers threatening to destroy each other.
Did you personally feel... not terror, but were you afraid there would be a nuclear holocaust, that it was imminent?
My thing really was, I didn't feel an immediate sense of danger, but I very strongly felt I don't want people from another country to perceive that I'm part of something that's threatening their existence. Obviously, we got the Western perspective, which very much portrayed us as we are the strong guys, and yeah, that wasn't something that appealed to me, to make people elsewhere that I hadn't met feel under threat, and I imagined that they would be feeling scared, and that's something I didn't like.
Yeah. Did you have any involvement with peace movements at all, either by sort of being aware of them or a member of CND, anything like that?
No, mainly because they weren't immediately visible to my little humdrum everyday life. So, but it was very much an ambition, something that I wanted to do. I wanted to seek out groups that were doing something, and that were being very effective.
So how did you find out about Greenham?
I had a couple of friends who somehow or other had picked up newsletters, so we just decided to go along and see what was happening at the camps.
And what made you decide to live at Yellowgate?
Well, the first time we visited, we just went up for the day, we then said we would come back for the Hiroshima Day actions, which happened every year and were a big focus of the camp. So we arrived just before Hiroshima Day in 1989, and as we arrived we found the road outside the camp was blocked off. There was lots of police and an ambulance arrived on the scene, and that was maybe half an hour before a Welsh woman called Helen Thomas had been killed by a West Midlands police horse box. So we became very involved in supporting the women and Helen's family, who the police tried to separate from the women. But Helen's mum was very clear that she wanted to meet the women that had been working with her daughter. And just the whole intensity of the incredible grief and the unpleasant, dishonest way in which the police described their involvement in Helen's death.
How did they describe their involvement?
They of course, being the police and Helen being identified not as a woman in her own right, but as a lump with the Greenham women, they blamed Helen and said she was dancing in the road, which she wasn't. She was just waiting to post a letter, waiting for the traffic to clear.
Did she live at Yellowgate?
Yes, she did. Yes, she did. She hadn't been living there very long at that stage, I think, but it was around about a year.
So what did Helen's parents say about the police involvement, the involvement of the military personnel? Who actually witnessed it, other than the Greenham women, and obviously the person who knocked her over?
Well, I suppose they were the two main witnesses, obviously with very, very conflicting descriptions. Although one of the policemen, PC Conway, he resigned from the police because of the way that he saw other police officers describing what happened to her.
Did he do that at the time or later on?
A few months afterwards, yeah.
And what were the conflicts in... witness statements and things, do you know?
Well, yes, the main conflict was the police said that Helen was in the road, that she was dancing, trying to portray her as irresponsible and careless, whereas women saw that she was waiting to go and post a letter. There was a postbox just opposite the road, and there was a kind of island in two parts. So there was a hatched section where Helen was waiting.
Was it witnessed by army personnel, British army personnel, or
no? So the because of the geography of the base, the military personnel were all within the fence, and they wouldn't have had sight of what was going on.
Yeah. And what happened at the coroner's inquest later on, which would have been a few months later, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yes, well, obviously women very much challenged the statements of the police, but the eventual verdict was accidental death. And there was, I think what we really wanted was an apology, some accountability for the police and some honesty in that what probably happened was that the wing mirror clipped Helen's head and then she got dragged under, but those things we never got.
So they weren't accounted for at all?
No.
Interesting. And did her parents take the matter on further after that?
No, they weren't. They were very dignified.
Grief-stricken.
Yeah, but I'm amazingly strong, and as I say, very, very dignified. They had a lot of support from their community as well, but they felt that wasn't something that they wanted to pursue, although they felt they hadn't got the apology that they needed and the honest account of what happened. They decided that wasn't something that they wanted to pursue.
How did the women at Greenham remember Helen?
Oh, she was always in our thoughts. She was always somebody that we spoke about whenever the media or other women came to visit the camp. And we built very strong relationships with groups in Wales. And in fact, I think two women, when the camp closed down, moved to live in Wales because of the strength of contact. So there was the Care Cochion Care Deeth, which I think is the Red Choir of Cardiff. They came down to support a lot whenever women were in court or doing big actions over Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day, and also in December, which was the anniversary of when the camp was set up.
And any other groups, which are just the choir
ones? Several peace groups, probably mainly based around Cardiff.
That's where Helen was from, born?
No, she came from a little village called Newcastle Emlyn.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh God, tragic for her parents. I wonder, they're probably not alive now, are they?
They could be. They're strong Welsh people. Helen was 23 at the time.
Very young.
Yeah. So she would. Yeah. If they are alive, they'll be very, very elderly.
And how long had she been at the camp for?
So I think she'd been living there for about a year, but very involved before that. And as a student and somebody working with Women's Aid, she was very politically active before that, and was part of a group that tried to stop Viraj Mendis, who was a can't remember where he came, Indian asylum seeker, maybe seeking refuge in Manchester, that the Home Office were trying very hard to get rid of and eventually succeeded. But Helen and a group of her friends tried to stop the plane taking off when he was being removed.
And did the women make any physical memorial?
Yes,
her?
Yes.
Because nowadays everyone puts flowers straight away.
Yes,
and all that sort of
yeah.
Thing.
Well, the site of the peace camp outside the main gate, which is where Yellow Gate was, there is now a memorial to the peace camp as a whole, and as part of that, there's a memorial garden to Helen
in her name.
And there's a board that explains about her life and how she was killed.
It's interesting. The policeman resigned.
Yes. He didn't want to be part of an organisation that treated people's lives like that, and then B wasn't honest about it. And he said that there was an orchestrated attempt to get all the statements to collaborate, which he didn't want to do.
Which was done by the police.
Yeah.
And only
yeah.
the police.
Yeah.
No one else.
Yeah.
Was
no.
Involved.
No.
Mm. No. Poor Helen, such a young girl as well. It's just horrible. How many women were living at Yellowgate, roughly, when you arrived?
It was a small group, fluctuating between maybe about six or eight full-time women, and then other time other women coming in on lengthy part-time basis, and then other people kind of dropping in and out. But when I was there, it was very much, it was 1989, so that's very much when the media spotlight was not on the camp at all, and most people thought the problem of nuclear missiles had been solved and done and dusted. And sadly, even today, it's, you know, it's something that I think we should all be thinking about and all be trying to do something about.
Well, it's very relevant in terms of Trump and
Kim's
Hanoi.
Yeah, India and Pakistan as well.
Yeah, India and Pakistan especially.
Mm. Russia.
It's endless, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So, just so I'm clear in my mind, did you live permanently at Yellowgate, or were you always going in and out?
So, for 4 years, I was part-time, kind of, I would say 50-50 part-time while I was studying and then spending a year in France. But from 1990, 1993 onwards, yes, I was full-time. So I lived there full-time for 4 years.
That's a long time. Were you in a bender?
By then, the evictions, which were very violent and very frequent in the early days, that was, in military terms, I think you would probably call that a war of attrition, which the women won. So the evictions were not so frequent. And by then, we had bought a piece of land, which was in our name, largely through a donation from Yoko Ono, as well as others. Mm. So we established, first of all, teepees on that bit of land, and then a mobile home. And then we had caravans outside the main gate, which could be moved if necessary. Mm. So, the structures, although not ideal, they were much more substantial than just the tents and benders in which women lived for years.
And the other gates, they were still in operation when you were there, Violet Gate?
Only occasionally, yeah. Not full time.
No one full time there?
No, Yellow Gate was the only full time. Yeah.
Mm. So, what sort of women were there when you arrived? Just sort of young, old?
Well, a mixture. Months. Young, old, international, Scottish, English. Several women who'd been there from 1983 onwards. One woman who'd been there pretty much from the start, who was, by then, she would be maybe early to mid-30s. Mm.
Was Sarah Hipperson?
Yes. Yeah, I suppose you didn't get a chance to interview her before she died.
But I listened to the Imperial War Museum.
Oh, yes.
Has her on tape, and you can, it's open access, so I listened to that online.
Oh, okay.
Which is fascinating. She was a very clear thinker.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Yes,
and obviously, being a working class Scottish woman, she had a very strong oral tradition. So yes, very, very easy to listen to with her very clear thoughts. So there was her, and I don't know if you did. You listen to the other woman from Yellowgate, who's called Onica Jones.
No, I didn't. I haven't listened to her, but she is available again. Yeah. I think. Actually, yes, I think I did.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have to go and listen to her.
Yeah.
Actually,
and Katrina?
Katrina House.
Yes.
No, I didn't listen to hers.
Yeah.
Largely because there were masses and masses of tapes.
Yes.
To run out of time.
Yeah. So Sarah died last November.
And Helen Johns died not so long ago as well.
Mm. Mm. Yeah.
The international women, excuse me, where did they come from? What countries? Were there any particular countries they seemed to come from, or was it just random?
We had strong links with a Canadian woman who knew another Scottish Canadian woman. Women in Japan, there was ongoing contact with women in Japan, obviously over the Hiroshima-Nagasaki issue. And I think possibly when women went to prison, they would meet women, international women in prison as well. So it was very much part of our focus that it was a worldwide movement to defeat nuclear weapons in all countries.
Did those international women bring anything particular or different?
Fantastic resistance songs. So we really fought one of the world's biggest nuclear armies with just ourselves, the air that we breathed, the fire that we cooked our food on, and amazing songs. So they very much brought their own perspective. They brought their solidarity, and I think part of the psychology that makes nuclear weapons exist is because if you don't have a concept of what other people are like and what their countries come from, it kind of makes it much easier to dehumanize people and undermine the value of their existence. So I think psychologically it was very important to make contact with women who were either in struggle in their own countries or were threatened by nuclear weapons. So we had a lot of contact with Irish women, and we supported the women in Northern Ireland who at that time were working against the military in Northern Ireland.
Did you go on any trips overseas yourself?
I personally didn't, but other women did. And there was an Irish woman called Margaretta Darcy who is married or was married to the playwright John Arden. Mm. And they did many anti-colonial plays, and she was fantastic for bringing drama and music to the camp, which we incorporated that into our resistance. We would do circus routines in front of the main gate while the nuclear convoy was coming out, which it stopped the nuclear convoy, but it also is very good for keeping your spirits up. And it was a humorous, playful way to defeat the military.
And singing, did you sing to the soldiers the other side of the
wire? Well, we weren't so much singing to the soldiers. We were mainly singing for ourselves. Yes, I did. I have a really terrible voice, so I would offer to sing some of the songs, but I won't because my voice is so terrible.
No, it's
fine. But it's, singing was a vital part, A, of keeping your spirits up, but also, again, it's a psychological thing to change the dynamic of tension when you're faced with a big organisation, lots of men in uniform in front of something that has the power to destroy the world. Singing was another subtle way of undermining their power and saying, we're on some level, whatever it is, we're not frightened by you, and you don't have the right to threaten our lives. Though you're being paid to do that and everything's set up for you to do that, morally, nobody has the right to do that.
Do you remember any of the lyrics of those songs?
I do, yes.
Could you say some?
The one that really I think is associated with Greenham is "You can't kill the spirit. She is like a mountain, old and strong. She goes on and on."
And who came up with that? Was that just a sort of joint decision by everyone?
I don't know. It's entirely possible that it predates Greenham. Mm. But it's something that we took up and used on every non-violent direct action that we did. I keep meaning to look up the history of that song. And I might have done at some stage.
It could
but
be a
forgot.
Very old folk
yes,
song or something.
Yeah,
like
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
It's all worth researching, yeah. So contact with the other side of the wire, was there much other than when the convoys came out, or did you recognise faces and sort of get to know people in any way at all?
So I think we tried to keep our relationship. They were there to do a job of work. We were there to do a job of work. Sometimes the MOD police and soldiers would be violent towards women.
In what way would that
be? So there was a guy, I can't remember his name, and I think it was probably before the time that I went to the camp. He was known as Thumper because when women were arrested on the base and there were porter cabins for them to be processed, he hit women in the chest before being interviewed. So, all sorts of physical violence. And the bailiffs as well, they would be violent towards women.
Did you experience any particular act of violence?
No, apart from the worst form of violence, that of Helen being killed and her death being lied about.
The women who were hit by, for example, Thumper, did they ever try and take it on and make a formal complaint to the bailiff?
Of course, yes, yeah. That? And there were other instances where the squaddies, not necessarily coming directly from the base, but say on a night out, would come to the camp and not directly attack the women, but just do things like urinate on tents, chuck things around, shout and kind of throw their weight around. It was always an uphill struggle to get the police to do anything about that. And frequently we had to do things like occupy the sentry box that was outside the main gate so that people would come and investigate. And obviously the investigations were very cursory and strangely found that nobody ever did anything wrong or violent. I do think there has been a slight shift in police accountability since the McPherson report, but that's not to say that police still don't treat protesters like that. And in fact, they very much do on the recent student loans demonstrations and anti-fracking camps. I think activists have come in for the same level of treatment.
I've lost my line of thought. You were saying there was sort of bad behaviour, aggressive behaviour by the squatters. Did the locals bother you at all?
Yes. They also thought it would be a good idea to join in on the bad behaviour. I think any minority definitely. Some women would occasionally scream as they drove past from their cars, but it, you know, goodness knows what they were saying. They weren't all in favor of us, but yes, I think it's just that thing about you're a vulnerable marginalized group that the press, some sections of the press, think that they can have a go at. Some people think that that means it's open season for abusing you and kind of taking out all their aggression.
And do you think the fact you were women had anything to do with that?
Yes. The misogyny thing as well, which seems to lurk just below the surface.
And when you went into town to presumably go shopping or whatever, pick up supplies, what was the atmosphere like then? And did it change over the time? Because you were there a long time.
Yeah, so I think probably the main change was from, say, 1981 when the camp was first set up, probably until the mid-80s. I would imagine on the whole people's will to kind of have any energy for reacting adversely to the presence of women in Newbury have probably ran out by then. So going into town, yes, not a problem at all. And the cafe by the station, the Empire Cafe in particular, was very supportive and very welcoming for us. And that was a very much a haven.
Did you know someone, maybe she was a Canadian-American, someone called Janet Tavner?
No, she wasn't Canadian-American. She got removed. She's a Swedish woman.
Swedish.
Ah. Yeah, so absolutely. Yes, I was there when she got taken from Salisbury Plain. Nobody would tell us anything.
Sorry to interrupt, were you on an action?
Yes.
Tell me the story, if you would.
Okay, so there's a village in Salisbury Plain called Imber, which was taken during the Second World War, and the villagers were told, you'll get your village back either at the end of the war or by some date. I can't remember, whichever comes first, you'll get your village back. But they never got it back. And it was used as one of the places where the cruise convoy was exercised, and it was also used for training soldiers in how to fight with civilian populations, and particularly at that time, obviously the population of Northern Ireland was in mind. So we would frequently go, probably as part of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki Day actions, but also I think on the anniversary of when the village was taken, we went to open up the church to put flowers in there, and we would sleep in the church. So I think it was on one of those actions we were all arrested. One by one, women were released from the police station.
Who arrested you? The British Army?
MOD police.
MOD police.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Obviously, there aren't people there all the time, but I think in the morning somebody comes to check on the village, and at that point they found us. So, and then we went to Salisbury Police Station because that's the nearest processing centre. So one by one, women were released, but Janet wasn't. So one of the women, Annika Jones, she went round the back of the police station, banging on all the windows and shouting for Janet, and saying, what are you in for? And Janet told us then that that was immigration. So she was held for some weeks in Puckle Church Removal Centre, and removed. She was removed on the wrong basis, and that was another case that we fought and won. She was removed for not having a valid visa, which was incorrect. And she, after she was removed, she did come back and support the camp while it was still in existence. Well, first of all, she had to go via Ireland, and then Sweden joined the EU. I can't remember when. Probably 1991 or something like that. And then, yeah, to come back, no problem. Yeah, so I still go and visit her a lot, although whether I'll be allowed to do that after Brexit, who knows?
It's not getting the Brexit. I think the world has gone crazy at the moment.
Twas ever thus.
Yeah,
twas ever thus.
Just going back to Janet Tavner, was there a vigil that Heathrow...
There was, yes, yeah.
To see her off, presumably.
Well, no, we wanted to, yes, going, yeah, so. Yeah. We actually got right up, one of the women, in fact, the woman who went round to the police cells and found out...
Annika
Jones, yes, yeah. She got right up to the last security gate, and... said she would have got on the plane, only she got Janet's name wrong. But yes, I was very much part of that vigil, which wanted to oppose her being removed from the UK. Yeah.
And how did the police treat you at the airport that day?
They weren't really fazed by it. I mean, you know, it was just a small group of us on our, you know, we. Very smartly dressed, very polite, very presentable. I guess those police are kind of used to dealing with the public in a public place, so that slightly changes the dynamic. Yeah.
The other thing about that particular episode was, is it true that people felt they were being watched by the authorities?
People were obviously living outside the camp. It's hard.
People at Greenham who went to see her off at Heathrow Airport and supported her. I read somewhere that someone thought that their movements were being watched, that you weren't aware of.
Well, by that stage, I was probably I wasn't quite living at the camp full time, but I never thought it unsurprising that the state might somehow be monitoring what we were up to. So it's hard to distinguish.
But you didn't
kind
feel
of...
any particular...
No.
Yeah.
No.
What kept you going until 1997?
Determination, I suppose. I mean, I It's hard to explain in a simple sentence. I love the smell of wood smoke. I love nature. I hate nuclear weapons. Women seem to be very effective at fighting nuclear weapons. It seemed to be a never-ending struggle. I liked meeting women from all over the UK. I liked knowing that my everyday actions were centred around non-violence and against the nuclear state, and there's always something to learn, always something to do.
How did it start to sort of tail off a bit?
It's a very intense situation, and by the time I left, it was 1997, so there was a smaller group living there full-time under immense pressure. Not many new women knew that the camp was there, so we didn't get as much support as we did, which means the work is much harder. And I suppose the energy started to run out.
Yeah, 8 years is a considerable time.
Yeah.
How many were left behind when you... When did Yellowgate close?
I think Yellowgate closed in 2001.
Sarah, the
last people, the last women there were really Sarah Hipperson, Katrina Howes, Jean Hutchinson, who was instrumental in fighting the bylaws. She took out a case against the Secretary of State, Michael Heseltine, and the House of Lords in 1989 found that the bylaws which allowed the military to occupy the common were unlawful. Her and another elderly Scottish woman called Peggy Walford, who had made many trips to the Soviet Union and had actually been thrown out of the Soviet Union for opposing Soviet weapons. So it was really those four, I think.
And how did you organise yourself at Yellowgate? There weren't that many of you. Did you discuss in huge detail any actions you were going to take? How did that all work?
Oh, well, by then, no, you didn't need to discuss it in much detail. Obviously, the nuclear missiles, the cruise missiles on the common would have left maybe something mid-90s, maybe. Anyway, it was a gradual phasing out. So there would be actions to make sure that the land really did go back to for use for people peaceful purposes.
And what sort of actions would they be? The
police occupied one of the buildings and they tried to carry out exercises to deal with people protesting. So we would disrupt those exercises.
Just inside,
in one of the few buildings that was up the main street coming from the main gate. We had meetings with Newbury District Council to make sure that it did go back to common land. And we were discussing having a museum on the common, but Newbury District Council's conditions for that were that the camp should close. So we said, oh, don't worry, it's okay, we'll do our own museum. Meanwhile, down the road at Aldermaston and Burfield, they were stepping up production of the Trident nuclear missile system. And every month there would be a new bunch of warheads that were being transported by road up to Faslane in Scotland. So we would try as hard as possible to disrupt those that transportation. And also,
how did you do that?
Well, we would watch the base, and there were certain signs when the missiles were due to be taken up. There'll be certain vehicles lining up. So then it's just a question of going back each day, finding out when they're going out, and then when they are leaving the base, we would follow them by car.
You had your own cars, presumably. Yeah.
And when they stopped off at various bases on the way, which would be Marham and Wittering, then we would disrupt them there as well, and we would go into those bases and say, take the weapons away, we're here to stop you getting those weapons into a state where you can use them. And on one occasion, I think it was RAF Marham or Wittering, there was a soldier who pointed his gun at women and said, stop or I'll shoot. And we went up to the Houses of Parliament the next day, I think, and asked Ken Livingstone to ask a question in Parliament about that.
Was the MP Clive Soley?
Yes.
Yeah.
So Clive Soley was involved in the eternal battle for press accountability and press responsibility. So he set up an organisation called Presswise, which was for people who'd been subject to incorrect, slanderous, libelous press treatment. We had much experience of that. Most notably, though, was an article that I think a subsidiary of the Mail wrote about a woman living at the camp, calling her common scrounger. Because as part of her income, as well as being a self-employed artist, she claimed job seeker's allowance. And she fought a successful libel action against
the Mail. Did she have to go right up to the High Court?
Yes. Yes, she did. Yeah.
Did she have the legal knowledge and the cash to pursue that?
So there never has been any legal aid for a libel action. In those days, it seemed quite shocking that there wasn't legal aid available. Nowadays, there's never legal aid or hardly legal aid for anything, sadly. She had lived at the camp since 1981, been fighting court cases on a weekly, monthly basis. So she didn't have all the legal knowledge necessary, but she knew the right places to go and look. I think in essence, it's probably that not that complicated. You just need the confidence to take a case, the time to spend documenting everything, and the ability to string a coherent legal argument together, all of those which she had many years practice in doing.
In abundance. What other media organisations were taken to court? Do you know
them? No, none were actually taken to court. We made several complaints to various organisations who we thought hadn't represented us fairly.
How were they representing you?
Well, it's a subtle thing, isn't it, the way that somebody is represented. So I think on the whole, probably fairly, quite fairly. There might have been, I think there were some women felt that our experience wasn't fully represented, and that obviously interviews would be truncated to focus mainly on the personal women's personal lives rather than what we wanted to talk about, the overall politics. So yeah, I don't really know what to say about the way that we were represented. Some people wrote really good articles. There was one by a guy called Cole Morton, who I don't know if he's still writing, but he wrote quite a good piece in The Independent. But mainly by 1989 and the mid-90s, people seemed to be fairly bored.
Was there a Green difference and women. Between the tabloid press and the broadsheets?
So the tabloids were really going for the kind of abusive, belittling, misogynistic kind of representation of what women were up to, and the whole concept of people non-violently resisting the military. Whereas the broadsheets would do a kind of cleverer job of belittling us sometimes, but they would also do a fairer representation. Yeah.
Well, did the TV cameras ever come when you were there? They were there at the beginning when all the big, you know, embrace the base.
Yes, that's right. Occasionally, yes. But mainly, in fact, I think exclusively local TV stations. Yeah. And they would come for, they didn't really come for big actions. They would come for big anniversaries, though. They liked the kind of commemorative, let's look back at when lots of women were here angle.
And were you ever arrested?
Yes, yeah. On many occasions I was arrested.
For what?
So my first arrest was for trespass. That was under the military bylaws that we later found unlawful. I was actually de-arrested from that.
De-arrested is sort of, well, you made a mistake, go home, or were you de-arrested?
So, well, I had never heard of being de-arrested, and strangely enough it's never happened to me since. But there was a group of women, and there was a December action. We went on to the runway that cruise missiles would have taken off from had there been any reason to use them, or no, that was where they were transported in on the runway. So we occupied the runway. It was quite a sizable group, I think maybe 12, 15 women. So they were all everybody else was carted off, and the policeman said to me, "Did anyone tell you you weren't meant to be on the base?" And I said, "Nobody had to. I knew I wasn't meant to be on the base." And he said, "Did any police officers tell you you weren't meant to be on the base?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I'm de-arresting you then."
Well, I've never heard that term before.
No, I haven't. And as I say, never again.
Was he an MOD police?
Yes, yeah. So all the police on the base were MOD police. Sometimes when you're arrested on an MOD property, there will be processing facilities there. There are at Aldermaston and Burfield, fairly small. But most of the time you're handed over from the MOD police to the civilian police. So trespass was my first action, and then criminal damage. I was arrested many times for criminal damage, things like cutting the fence at Aldermaston and Burfield to
so
get
you're
in.
Good with wire cutters and bolt cutters.
I'm not the world's quickest, but I do know how to use them. And after I left Greenham as well, I did several actions against the war in Iraq and against the build-up to the war in Iraq. So, yes, arrested on many occasions, caught for many court cases. Obstruction as well, that was another popular charge, for kind of, that's a blockading kind of charge. And altogether I've done 13 prison sentences.
I was going to ask you to take me through the process of you're doing your action and the police come along and they arrest you. Where did they take, were you put in a police van? What happened immediately after?
So if it was a Greenham arrest, if it wasn't a very big group, then we'd be processed on the base. If it was a very big group and there weren't the physical facilities to hold us, then you'd go to Newbury police station. First of all, they were minivans, and then in the mid 90s, somebody came up with riot vans, which kind of had separate, encapsulated, locked, horrible, cramped cells.
Yes,
which are meant to be very dangerous if there's any accident as well. Aldermaston and Burfield, again, smaller groups could be dealt with in those premises. If it was a large group, then we'd go to Reading and either be processed at the police station and then dealt with either Reading Magistrates Court or Reading Crown Court.
So were you kept in cells overnight to go to court the next day?
Oh, no. So, yes. Most of the time released on bail, although in the mid-90s a couple of women were remanded. And I was once remanded from Kettering, I think, on one of the occasions when we'd gone up to oppose the Trident convoys. I was I think I had an initial plea hearing, which is the first part of the court hearing. And we were used to not standing up for the magistrates to say, we don't respect your laws which protect nuclear weapons and not women. So I did that at court and gave my anti-aristocracy, anti-monarchy habitual speech. And I was remanded. I later found out one of the women who came along with me went, thanks a lot, you put him in really, really bad mood. And I went, who's he? She went, Lord so-and-so, the magistrate. But I was released after a week from that when I said, yeah, fair cop, it's all right.
And you were held
where? I was held in Holloway.
In Holloway?
Yeah, yeah.
Could you tell me something about that?
Holloway was the same as it ever was, but also women were remanded for doing fairly substantial criminal damage at Aldermaston and Burfield, I think.
Say fairly substantial, what do you mean?
Quite extensive damage to the fence, that obviously the state puts a monetary value on things. So prison, yes, it's a horrible place to be, and my abiding memories of prison is it's just full of women who are very, very distraught, who have very kind of fragile, kind of precarious lives.
Were they supportive, the non-green and the non-action women
there? Some supportive, some, you know, some just have to stick their heads down and get on with surviving day to day and don't really have much energy for other people or finding out about you. But yes, on the whole, very supportive.
So when you were taken from court to Holloway, that was in a prison van?
Yeah.
Like?
Claustrophobic. Police not always the best at driving, but I suppose the transportation sticks in my mind less than the actual prison sentence itself. I suppose there's a slight feeling of dread and anxiety on the journey.
What was the maximum length you did at Holloway?
So I don't think I ever did, as a whole sentence, anything more than 2 weeks, but I did obviously several sentences of a few weeks at a time, and depending on when you were sent down, because you never did all of your sentence, but depending on when you were sent down, you could end up doing a very short sentence if you were sent down on a Tuesday, and then the next day for release, if it goes over a certain date, then you have to be released slightly earlier. So sometimes I'd be sent down on a Tuesday but actually released on the Friday, because the numerical release date would fall over a weekend when it wasn't prison practice to release people.
And were you searched when you got to Holloway?
Yes. No uniforms. Yes, women were searched and strip searched as well. Margareta Darcy led a resistance to being strip searched in the mid-1990s, in which case women would be flung into solitary confinement sometimes. So we were kind of treated in prison by the prison officers more or less the same as all other women, and you know, prison officers, like anybody else, are a mixed bag.
Yeah, good ones, bad ones.
Yeah.
And how was it when you came out of Holloway prison into the sunlight again? How did you feel inside?
Well, the first time, it was very, very strange. As disorientating as it is going into prison, I felt a similar disorientation coming out. I remember thinking, why isn't anybody doing anything about the kind of the lack of anything constructive or rehabilitative in prison? And I'd heard several very harrowing stories about women's lives, and I do remember thinking it's kind of not right that most people aren't really aware that that's what the women who end up being in prison, that their lives are like. But obviously that kind of gradually recedes the more you get on with your daily life. But yes, being released was very initially very disorientating, and I suppose it's just kind of processing the overall kind of intensity of the experience, which takes, yeah, it takes a lot of emotions.
It didn't deter you.
No.
Do you still think about it?
No, no, good. Not very often, no.
Last convoys of the missiles at Greenham, when did they leave?
I think that would be the 90s. Early 90s, yeah. 90s, yeah, like probably around about 92, 93. They would still, even when the inter-range nuclear forces treaty, the INF treaty, the one that Trump and Putin have now gone back on, even when that was signed, the cruise missiles were still being exercised. So every time they were exercised, they would be opposed. There were also, at that time, Soviet delegations coming in to do inspections. So we would meet those as well and say all nuclear weapons
are
bad.
And did you have a chance to talk to them and exchange any sort of...
Obviously, the last convoy that left, we very much celebrated that, it was a gradual process as well of removing the security infrastructure around the base. When the police withdrew, they took to locking the perimeter fence up and the security box at night, and we went in for sawing the chains off and removing the main gate and fully opening up the common.
Do you think the women were particularly imaginative of the things? Because I've heard so many stories and some great putting honey round locks.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, we also did things like on Salisbury Plain when the missiles were being exercised, we would dress up as sheep. And
well, I haven't heard that.
Yeah. Give our names as Larry Jacobs, which yes, it's a communal imagination, I think.
Did they laugh when they saw you as sheep and giving your name as Larry, whatever? Did they see the absurdity of it all?
I think on some level they did. I find it hard to imagine that anyone wouldn't. But they kind of suppressed it because they were in a role where,
Oh, gosh. Any other things like that?
We wrote a book. I don't know. Have you managed to get hold of a copy?
Is that
of
the
it?
One that has every single action?
Yes.
That's going through right from the beginning? Yeah, I've loaned my copy to someone, but I think it's the one that you have.
It's from...
Rose is just getting her book. That's the one. Yeah. I've got this because it's very useful. I found it very useful, not only just from sort of chronology, it was to see the range of actions that were taken. And the persistence that was required. It was... I don't remember those photos in mine. Maybe it's a different edition.
No, there was only ever
one.
Only one
edition.
Yeah, quite a limited print run, which sold out.
I found it on a book.
Okay.
And bought it. All right, where else? Yeah, we're talking about the... international women that from all over the world there. Was there any racism at Greenham that you know, not necessarily when you were there, but if you...
Yes, there was. I think the racism was aligned with... there was a bit of a split in the peace movement about non-aligned. Yellowgate was strongly non-aligned, and very critical of Soviet nuclear missiles. And there was, women at Yellowgate felt there was quite a bit of racism towards a black woman involved at Yellowgate called Wilmette Brown. And there was
Who was Wilmette Brown?
So Wilmette Brown was working with the King's Cross Women's Centre, and there was a campaign called Wages for Housework, that was her focus at the time. Women at the 1987 Soviet Peace Conference, there was a verbal racist attack on Wilmette, which women
from another Greenham.
Also, I'm not sure if she wasn't living at Greenham, I don't think, but she was associated with Greenham. Yeah.
Do you know what form that? I mean, just a verbal.
Yes. It's possibly something that could have been resolved at the time, but it wasn't. It wasn't. That was 1987, which was obviously before the time that I was involved.
That must have had quite big repercussions, I just thought.
It did, it did. Well, after 1987, the peace movement, CND, the Quakers in Newbury completely withdrew support for Yellowgate. No financial support, no using of the shower facilities at the Quaker meeting house
Quakers
in Newbury.
Were very involved, weren't they?
Yes, yeah, as a whole, they withdrew as well after 1987. So, So then we, as a camp, we very much went it alone.
So, what do you think precisely is Greenham's legacy, really, for future for now and for future generations?
So the immediate legacy is no nuclear weapons on the common. The people of Newbury have their common land back, and people outside of Newbury can enjoy it as well. I gather there's a nature centre and ponies grazing on the land. Never again, I think, can a land-based nuclear weapon system be used in the UK, because the essence of Crewe's was that it would melt into the countryside, nobody would know where it was, and it would go all undetected. Not so. So whatever nuclear weapons there are, I think they can't be land-based, so they would have to be sea-based. Unfortunately, we haven't managed to stop the production of Trident. There weren't enough people aware at the time that Trident was being produced. Not enough people felt the same sense of urgency as during the Cold War to make them get up and do something about it. So the next effect, I would hope, is the huge inspirational effect that a group of non-violent women fought the world's probably most powerful superpower at that time and won just through non-violence. If people aren't really mindful of Greenham's legacy and what women did, how we did it, how we achieved that victory, at the moment there may well be another time in history when people do remember. I think history isn't linear, it's circular. Sometimes history and uncovered stories are very much forgotten, but then I believe there'll be a time when people are looking for inspiration and may well come across the story of Greenham again.
Do you find people are still aware of Greenham, or do you find millennials know about Greenham?
Are millennials young people?
I think so. I think that's a sort of...
I never really... I'm sorry.
20-something, but I think I'm a baby boomer, and I think millennials are around about my daughter's age, maybe a bit younger, actually.
So, no, I don't think they are aware of it. But I think the tradition of non-violent direct action very much persists. At the anti-fracking camps definitely carry on in the tradition of Greenham, and there will be some women who...
Would you say that's one of Greenham's legacies?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The Newbury Road protests, they were around during the end of the camp as well. So possibly the awareness of the camp at the moment isn't as much as it used to be.
Why do you think that is? It's part of British history. 20th century British history. Why are these young people...
Well, I think it's partly to do with each generation has its own kind of existential threat and existential thing that it has to deal with and come to terms with. In the 80s, it was the Cold War. And now it's very much climate change. So I think if you're talking about... protest movement or some kind of force for social change, it's climate change. The question of how to relate to people coming from other poorer parts of the country that have every right to live here and settle here, the refugee kind of question, I think that's much more in people's minds.
Than nuclear weapons.
And it's probably something to do with the way that people's minds, having never fully appreciated what Greenham was about and what it did, I think probably people see the fact that there aren't nuclear weapons on the common anymore. It's also because of Reagan and Gorbachev. So it's a whole mixture of factors. But nonetheless, the legacy still lives on. And I think Greenham was an internationally recognised movement and will be so again.
How do you inspire these millennials to take part, do you think, in more direct action rather than just clicking something on Twitter or whatever?
I don't know. I probably am not the person to ask about that. I was very politically engaged for a long time after I left Greenham, but I think you probably need to head over to Sweden and ask Greta Thunberg, who's the 16-year-old who's kind of kicked off a whole environmental movement.
So are you still politically involved in actions against things?
Not at the moment, no.
What did you do after Greenham?
So after Greenham, I worked with a charity called Bail for Immigration Detainees, which got people released from immigration removal centres. There was one close to Portsmouth called Hasler. I did that for 7 years. That's no longer, the Portsmouth office is no longer going. I was very active against the build-up to the Iraq War and the Iraq War. And then I had a daughter. I campaigned for Remain during the EU referendum. And I was for a while involved with the Labour Party after Jeremy Corbyn was elected, but I'm not quite so active now.
And what do you think your experiences at Green gave you in terms of going forward into those different involvements, if anything?
They definitely did give me a lot. Probably quite good... not necessarily legal training, but an understanding of how courts work, the kind of language that you need to use to do a good court case. So that was directly useful for when I was preparing and presenting bail applications at immigration courts. And obviously I'd had the experience of immigration tribunals with Janet when she was removed. An understanding of the way that groups work as well.
In terms of the group you lived with, and wider groups as well.
And an unshakable belief, even though I'm not putting that into practice at the moment, but an absolutely unshakable belief that individuals, when they get together to take on an injustice or a state authority, that they can fight and win. Mm.
Gosh. Excellent. And
I'm just going to turn that tap
yeah,
off.
Torture. What do you think Greenland did for women in a broad sense?
Mm, well, interesting question. Some women got careers from the back of the work that they did at Greenland. It was an essential part of the women's movement, so it gave women a personal sense of empowerment, I think. I'm not sure about the whole women thing at the moment. There seems to be very much a backlash against women being strong, powerful individuals. It's given women a very good model for getting together and speaking out about big, major political issues. Anything else?
Do you tell your daughter about Greenland? I don't know how old she is.
My daughter's nine.
Yeah.
I can't help myself. I can't stop myself from discussing politics and kind of...
Does she ask you the stories, though, about Greenland?
No.
Does she know you were at Greenland?
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah. And she knows that I've been to prison. Maybe when she's a bit older,
yeah.
I'll take her there. But yes, I mean, my just on a very tiny level, when she was very young and asking for pink things, I would say, why do you have to have pink things? And she's known from a very early age that all colours are for everyone. I think the way the feminist movement went, it didn't go down the route of really challenging the way that power structures are set up and who benefits from them, and maybe trying to redistribute things a bit more. It kind of went down the route of there are some top jobs to be had. Why can't some of the women have those? Which, you know, I guess that's a kind of valid route.
Sort of part of it, but
yeah, but it's not, it's very much not the whole story, and it's not the route that I wanted to go down either.
If you could go back in time.
Yeah.
All those years ago,
oh, God, no, I don't.
Would you do anything differently?
That is something I do frequently ask in myself. I'm going to have to say no, because I had a lot of choices available to me at the time. I did have agency. Greenland was very much where my heart was at. And even though it was hard and leaving the camp was hard, I think I would still do it again. Yeah, yeah, definitely.
There were so few of you living at the gate. Mm. Could you have not lived there and still achieved what
No.
So place was important.
Absolutely, absolutely. Not just place, but structuring your daily life around non-violent resistance. It's very hard to do that. That's why the Occupy movement, I think, was so successful and generated such an energy, because it's not just the same place. It's like, well, we're all in the same place, but there's nothing else to do, so let's do that job
of
work.
Think direct witness is important as well, being there and seeing things.
Yes.
And why do you think that's important?
Well, because I think the state always does a very good job of putting its view across and saying, this is what's happening, it's like this, but you absolutely need people to say, no, I've been there, I've seen it, and that's actually not what's happening. So, yeah.